This is the story. The strange story of one of the modern world's most commonplace products, which was once worth more than life itself. And you'll hear another story. The story of a great career that was made possible by two fish heads. This is the story. A city of Samarkand, a glittering, turbulent jewel stud in the vast and fertile pasture lands of Central Asia, lay astride the great trade route to the exotic, fabulous land of China. And though the Shah of that Muslim city was in the year 751 A.D. a man of peace, his domain was plagued by war, the price Samarkand paid for its strategic location on the great east-west road of commerce. For months now, the swirling maelstrom of life that was characteristic of Samarkand had been stilled. The ebb and flow of commerce had ceased, stagnated. For a vast Chinese army that had come out of the east surrounded the city, laying siege to it, cutting it off from the rest of the world. Having found with three futile attacks that it could not take Samarkand by storm, the Chinese army had adopted a policy of attempting to starve the city into submission. But in this strategy, the attackers had not reckoned with the determination of the people of Samarkand and the Shah who ruled them never to be conquered. Though his people were hungry to the point of starvation, though his usually bustling city was as quiet as a tomb, the Shah resolutely declared,
"If my city is conquered, it shall be conquered by swords, not by hunger. If we are to die, we shall not wait for death to come to us. We shall seek it out. Prepare to attack the despoilers of our land."
And so for weeks, the people of Samarkand prepared to break the siege. And when all was in readiness, a great attack was mounted with every man, woman, and child bearing arms against the Chinese. A furious, bloody battle was joined with the people of Samarkand fighting like demons. For 3 days, the battle raged, surging back and forth across the great green pasture land surrounding Samarkand. And then on the fourth day, a messenger raced into the palace of the Shah, shouting,
The Chinese retreat. The siege is broken, Almighty One. Samarkand lives and breathes again.
Out on the pasture land, the people of Samarkand buried their dead and the dead of the vanquished enemy, and then putting their prisoners in chains, marched back into the city. The Chinese prisoners were herded into the Shah's palace and made to kneel before the victorious ruler of the city. And to the captives, the Shah declared,
"For the crime of attacking my city, which sought peace, not war, you must pay, either with your lives or with a ransom you consider more worthy than your lives."
The Chinese prisoners kneeling there before the Shah knew immediately that he had decreed their death, for they possessed nothing which they considered more valuable than their lives. The few pieces of gold and silver they had in their pockets, would their captors spare their lives in exchange for them? The Shah scornfully rejected this pitiful offer and ordered the prisoners thrown into a dungeon to await execution. After weeks of languishing in their dungeon, the Chinese prisoners were at last brought into the public square of Samarkand to be executed. The Shah himself was present to preside over the death ceremony. The doomed men lined up before a blood-red carpet and ordered to cast all of their earthly belongings upon it. This they did, stripping their pockets of their pieces of gold and silver and personal possessions. And as the Shah watched, he was fascinated by something that fluttered down upon the carpet from the hands of several of the condemned men. So fascinated was he, in fact, that when the executioner stepped forward with his large and deadly knife, the Shah raised a restraining hand, saying,
"Wait!"
And snatching one of the objects of his utter fascination from the blood-red carpet, he turned to the Chinese and demanded,
"What is this? I have never before set eyes upon anything of its kind."
The Chinese told him, explaining, while their executioner waited with his knife poised, what the thing was the Shah held in his hand, what it was used for, and how it was made. The Shah then asked,
"You are skilled in the making of this?"
The prisoners replied that they were, and to their joy and amazement, the Shah declared,
"Then you shall not die. For if you impart to me the secret of making that which I hold in my hand, you will have paid a ransom more valuable than your lives."
And so the lives of those Chinese prisoners were spared in exchange for teaching the people of Samarkand how to make a thing which no man outside of China had ever seen before. A product which, when knowledge of its manufacture spread from the city of Samarkand to the Middle East and Europe, brought about the greatest upsurge in learning in the history of the world. For you see, until those Chinese prisoners imparted their life-saving secret to the Shah of Samarkand, all writing had to be done on the skin of animals. And the making of books was impossible, an unknown thing. For the curious thing that fluttered down on the blood-red carpet that day, the thing that the Shah of Samarkand valued more highly than life, was a piece of paper. Yes, paper. This is the story. The distance between the little village of Lüneburg and the city of Hamburg in Germany is 25 miles, a 2 or perhaps 3 day journey by horse cart or coach in the year 1700. And no one, even in that day, walked 25 miles without a pfennig in his pocket, without good and sufficient reason. And so it goes without saying that the 15-year-old boy's motives for getting to Hamburg were of the strongest. In Hamburg, he could study under the great Adam Rankin. A soiled letter from Rankin, which the lad carried in his pocket, ensured this. "Come to Hamburg," the great man's letter had read, "and I will be pleased to tutor you, for I think you're a young man of great musical talent." But when he had said, "Come to Hamburg," Rankin had had no idea that the youth would have to come walking without a pfennig to his name. He knew that the boy's parents were dead, but Rankin also knew that he had an older brother who was comfortably situated financially. But what he did not know was that when the lad had gone to his brother for sufficient money to go to Hamburg, he had been cynically and unsympathetically rebuffed.
"You'll get not one pfennig from me. Now get this foolish notion of becoming a musician out of your mind. I have other plans for you."
Other plans? The boy knew what his tight-fisted brother meant. The youth was to become a merchant or tradesman if his brother had his way. Well, he was not going to have his way. Upon this, the lad was determined. And so, in the dark of the night, he had run away from his brother's home and started his long trek, though he had no idea what or how he would eat along the way, or for that matter, how he would live without any money once he reached Hamburg. On the first 2 days of his journey, the youth had successfully fought off the growing pangs of hunger. But now, as evening shadows crowded in upon the third day, the painful gnawing in his empty stomach would not be denied. Weakly, he struggled on, with his feet feeling like heavy boulders, while his knees were of the consistency of water. And then, suddenly, to increase his misery, the odor of warm, savory food came to him. The smell was like a fiendish, merciless spirit taunting and mocking him in his hunger. The youth looked up from the road and found himself in front of an inn. If he did not have the money to purchase any of the wonderful food he smelled, at least it cost nothing to sit beside the inn and revel in the flavorful odor. And so he dropped to the ground beneath a window and breathed deeply, closing his eyes and picturing himself sitting at a banquet table, feasting upon all manner of good things to eat. But his daydream was soon interrupted by the opening of the window beside which he was sitting and a voice that shouted,
"Look out!"
The boy hopped to his feet just as a bucket of swill came cascading out of the window and onto the ground beside him. The boy looked down at the garbage, and there at his feet were two fish heads. Quickly, he snatched them up, and only after he held them in his hand did he realize with revulsion that his hunger had driven him to eating garbage. And as he continued to stare at the fish heads, all the futility and hopelessness of his journey to Hamburg closed in upon him. Perhaps with these two fish heads to sustain him, he could struggle on to the city, but what would he do after he arrived there? He had no money, nothing. Back in Lüneburg, back in his brother's home, he would at least have food and shelter. Going back would mean giving up his ambition to become a musician and composer. But perhaps he could reconcile himself to the life and work of a tradesman. And so he sat there beside the inn with those two fish heads in his hands. And the youth decided to retrace his steps to Lüneburg, turning his back forever on a musical career. With that decision made, he broke open the fish heads. He would eat one now and save the other until... The youth gaped at the broken fish heads in his hands, dumbfounded by what he saw inside them. Within each of them, there was a gold coin, and each gold coin was worth 2 marks. Shedding his despair like a coat, the lad dashed into the inn, displayed his strangely acquired wealth, and ordered the innkeeper to immediately bring him a large dinner. There was no thought of returning to Lüneburg now. With the money he'd found in the fish heads, he could go on to Hamburg and live until he found a job that would give him time to study under the great Adam Reinken. And this he did, going on from his student years to become the musical giant of his day. But often in his busy career, he paused to speculate on the strange miracle of the fish heads that had saved him from the drab and hated life of a tradesman. And though no one has ever been able to explain where those 2 gold coins came from or how they got into the fish heads, the world has been a better place for their having been there. For because of those 2 coins, the youth whose career they saved went on to triumph after triumph until he became one of the greatest, if not the greatest, composer in the history of the world, Johann Sebastian Bach. Yes, this is the story.